This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents We Were Soldiers Once and Young, Ia Drang, The Battle That Changed the War in Vietnam, by Harold G. Moore and Joseph L. Galloway, narrated by Jonathan Davis. Prologue. In thy faint slumbers I by thee have watched and heard thee murmur tales of iron wars. Shakespeare, Henry IV, Part 1, Act 2, Scene 3. This story is about time and memories. The time was 1965, a different kind of year. A watershed year when one era was ending in America and another was beginning. We felt it then in the many ways our lives changed so suddenly, so dramatically. And looking back on it from a quarter century gone, we are left in no doubt. It was the year America decided to directly intervene in the Byzantine affairs of obscure and distant Vietnam. It was the year we went to war. In the broad traditional sense, that we who went to war was all of us. All Americans, though in truth at that time the larger majority had little knowledge of, less interest in, and no great concern with what was beginning so far away. So this story is about the smaller, more tightly focused we of that sentence. The first American combat troops, who boarded World War II-era troop ships, sailed to that little-known place and fought the first major battle of a conflict that would drag on for 10 long years and come as near to destroying America as it did to destroying Vietnam. The Ia Drang campaign was to the Vietnam War what the terrible Spanish Civil War of the 1930s was to World War II. A dress rehearsal. The place where new tactics, techniques, and weapons were tested, perfected, and validated. In the Ia Drang, both sides claimed victory and both sides drew lessons, some of them dangerously deceptive, which echoed and resonated throughout the decade of bloody fighting and bitter sacrifice that was to come. This is about what we did, what we saw, what we suffered in a 34-day campaign in the Ia Drang Valley of the Central Highlands of South Vietnam in November 1965, when we were young and confident and patriotic, and our countrymen knew little and cared less about our sacrifices. Another war story, you say? Not exactly. For on the more important levels, this is a love story, told in our own words and by our own actions. We were the children of the 1950s, and we went where we were sent because we loved our country. We were draftees, most of us, but we were proud of the opportunity to serve that country just as our fathers had served in World War II and our older brothers in Korea. We were members of an elite experimental combat division, trained in the new art of air mobile warfare at the behest of President John F. Kennedy. Just before we shipped out to Vietnam, the Army handed us the colors of the historic 1st Cavalry Division, and we all proudly sewed on the big yellow and black shoulder patches with the horsehead silhouette. We went to war because our country asked us to go. Because our new president, Lyndon B. Johnson, ordered us to go. But more importantly, because we saw it as our duty to go. That is one kind of love. Another and far more transcendent love came to us unbidden on the battlefields, as it does on every battlefield in every war man has ever fought. We discovered in that depressing, hellish place, where death was our constant companion, that we loved each other. We killed for each other, we died for each other, and we wept for each other. And in time we came to love each other as brothers. In battle our world shrank to the man on our left, and the man on our right, and the enemy all around. We held each other's lives in our hands, and we learned to share our fears, our hopes, our dreams as readily as we shared what little else good came our way. We were the children of the 1950s and John F. Kennedy's young stalwarts of the early 1960s. He told the world that Americans would pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship in the defense of freedom. We were the down payment on that costly contract. But the man who signed it was not there when we fulfilled his promise. John F. Kennedy waited for us on a hill in Arlington National Cemetery. And in time, we came by the thousands to fill those slopes with our white marble markers and to ask on the murmur of the wind if that was truly the future he had envisioned for us. Among us were old veterans, grizzled sergeants who had fought in Europe and the Pacific in World War II, and had survived the frozen hell of Korea, and now were about to add another star to their combat infantryman's badge. They were regular Army enlistees, young men from America's small towns whose fathers told them they would learn discipline and become real men in the Army. There were other young men who chose the Army over an equal term in prison. Alternative sentencing, the judges call it now. But the majority were draftees, 19- and 20-year-old boys summoned from all across America by their local selective service boards to do their 2 years in green. The PFC soldiered for $99.37 a month. The sergeant's first class for $343.50 a month. Leading us were the sons of West Point, and the young ROTC lieutenants from Rutgers and the Citadel, and yes, even Yale University, who had heard Kennedy's call and answered it. There were also the young enlisted men and NCOs who passed through Officer Candidate School and emerged newly minted officers and gentlemen. All laughed nervously when confronted with the cold statistics that measured a second lieutenant's combat life expectancy in minutes and seconds, not hours. Our second lieutenants were paid $241.20 per month. The class of 1965 came out of the old America, a nation that disappeared forever in the smoke that billowed off the jungle battlegrounds where we fought and bled. The country that sent us off to war was not there to welcome us home. It no longer existed. We answered the call of one president who was now dead. We followed the orders of another who would be hounded from office and haunted by the war he mismanaged so badly. Many of our countrymen came to hate the war we fought. Those who hated it the most, the professionally sensitive, were not, in the end, sensitive enough to differentiate between the war and the soldiers who had been ordered to fight it. They hated us as well. And we went to ground in the crossfire, as we had learned in the jungles. In time, our battles were forgotten, our sacrifices were discounted, and both our sanity and our suitability for life in polite American society were publicly questioned. Our young old faces, chiseled and gaunt from the fever and the heat and the sleepless nights, now stare back at us, lost and damned strangers, frozen in yellowing snapshots packed away in cardboard boxes with our medals and ribbons. We rebuilt our lives, found jobs or professions, married, raised families, and waited patiently for America to come to its senses. As the years passed, we searched each other out and found that the half-remembered pride of service was shared by those who had shared everything else with us. With them, and only with them, could we talk about what had really happened over there, what we had seen, what we had done, what we had survived. We knew what Vietnam had been like, and how we looked and acted and talked and smelled. No one in America did. Hollywood got it wrong every damned time, wetting twisted political knives on the bones of our dead brothers. So once, just this once, this is how it all began, what it was really like, what it meant to us, and what we meant to each other. It was no movie. When it was over, the dead did not get up and dust themselves off and walk away. The wounded did not wash away the red and go on with life unhurt. Those who were miraculously unscratched were by no means untouched. Not one of us left Vietnam the same young man he was when he arrived. This story, then, is our testament and our tribute to 234 young Americans who died beside us during 4 days in Landing Zone X-Ray and Landing Zone Albany in the Valley of Death, 1965. That is more Americans than were killed in any regiment, north or south, at the Battle of Gettysburg, and far more than were killed in combat in the entire Persian Gulf War. 70 more of our comrades died in the Iah Drang in desperate skirmishes before and after the big battles at X-Ray and Albany. All the names, 305 of them, including one Air Force pilot, are engraved on the third panel to the right of the apex, panel 3 East, of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., and on our hearts. This is also the story of the suffering of families whose lives were forever shattered by the death of a father, a son, a husband, a brother in that valley. While those who have never known war may fail to see the logic, this story also stands as tribute to the hundreds of young men of the 320th, 33rd, and 66th Regiments of the People's Army of Vietnam who died by our hand in that place. They too fought and died bravely. They were a worthy enemy. We who killed them pray that their bones were recovered from that wild, desolate place where we left them and taken home for decent and honorable burial. This is our story and theirs. For we were soldiers once, and young. Going to War. Chapter 1. Heat of Battle. You cannot choose your battlefield. God does that for you. But you can plant a standard where a standard never flew. Stephen Crane. The Colors. The small bloody hole in the ground that was Captain Bob Edwards' Charlie Company command post was crowded with men. Sergeant Herman R. Hostetler, 25, from Terra Alta, West Virginia, lay crumpled in the red dirt, dead from an AK-47 round through his throat. Specialist 4 Ernest E. Paolone of Chicago, the radio operator, crouched low, bleeding from a shrapnel wound in his left forearm. Sergeant James P. Castleberry, the artillery forward observer, and his radio operator, PFC Irvin L. Brown, Jr., hunkered down beside Paolone. Captain Edwards had a bullet hole in his left shoulder and armpit and was slumped in a contorted sitting position, unable to move and losing blood. He was holding his radio handset to his ear with his one good arm. A North Vietnamese machine gunner atop a huge termite hill, no more than 30 feet away, had them all in his sights. We lay there watching bullets kick dirt off the small parapet around the edge of the hole, Edwards recalls. I didn't know how badly I had been hurt, only that I couldn't stand up, couldn't do very much. The two platoon leaders I had radio contact with, Lieutenant William W. Franklin on my right and Lieutenant James L. Lane on Franklin's right, continued to report receiving fire, but had not been penetrated. I knew that my other two platoons were in bad shape and the enemy had penetrated to within hand grenade range of my command post. The furious assault by more than 500 North Vietnamese regulars had slammed directly into two of Captain Edwards' platoons, a thin line of 50 cavalry troopers who were all that stood between the enemy and my battalion command post, situated in a clump of trees in Landing Zone X-Ray, Iah Drang Valley in the central highlands of South Vietnam, early on November 15, 1965. America had drifted slowly but inexorably into war in this far-off place. Until now, the dying, on our side at least, had been by ones and twos during the advisor era just ended, then by fours and fives as the U.S. Marines took the field earlier this year. Now the dying had begun in earnest, in wholesale lots, here in this eerie forested valley beneath the 2,401-foot high crest of the Chupong Massif, which wandered 10 miles back into Cambodia. The newly arrived 1st Cavalry Division Airmobile had already interfered with and changed North Vietnamese Brigadier General Chu Huy Man's audacious plans to seize the Central Highlands. Now his goal was to draw the Americans into battle, to learn how they fought and teach his men how to kill them. One understrength battalion had the temerity to land by helicopter right in the heart of General Man's base camp, a historic sanctuary so far from any road that neither the French nor the South Vietnamese army had ever risked penetrating it in the preceding 20 years. My battalion, the 450-man 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry of the U.S. Army, had come looking for trouble in the Ia Drang. We had found all we wanted and more. Two regiments of regulars of the People's Army of Vietnam, PAVN, more than 2,000 men, were resting and regrouping in their sanctuary near here and preparing to resume combat operations when we dropped in on them the day before. General Mann's commanders reacted with speed and fury, and now we were fighting for our lives. One of Captain Edwards's men, Specialist 4 Arthur Vieira, remembers every second of Charlie Company's agony that morning. The gunfire was very loud. We were getting overrun on the right side. The lieutenant, Neil A. Kroger, 24, a native of Oak Park, Illinois, came up in the open in all this. I thought that was pretty good. He yelled at me. I got up to hear him. He hollered at me to help cover the left sector. Vieira adds, I ran over to him. By the time I got there, he was dead. He had lasted a half hour. I knelt beside him, took off his dog tags, and put them in my shirt pocket. I went back to firing my M79 grenade launcher and got shot in my right elbow. The M79 went flying, and I was knocked down and fell back over the lieutenant. I had my .45 and fired it with my left hand. Then I got hit in the neck and the bullet went right through. Now I couldn't talk or make a sound. I got up and tried to take charge and was shot a third time. That one blew up my right leg and put me down. It went in my leg above the ankle, traveled up and came back out, then went into my groin and ended up in my back, close to my spine. Just then, two stick grenades blew up right over me and tore up both my legs. I reached down with my left hand and touched grenade fragments on my left leg, and it felt like I had touched a red-hot poker. My hand just sizzled. When Bob Edwards was hit, he radioed for his executive officer, Lieutenant John Arrington, a 23-year-old South Carolinian who was over at the battalion command post rounding up supplies, to come forward and take command of Charlie Company. Edwards says, Arrington made it to my command post and, after a few moments of talking to me while lying down at the edge of the foxhole, was also hit and wounded. He was worried that he had been hurt pretty bad and told me to be sure and tell his wife that he loved her. I thought, doesn't he know I'm badly wounded too? He was hit in the arm and the bullet passed into his chest and grazed a lung. He was in pain, suffering silently. We also caught some shrapnel from an M79 that the North Vietnamese had apparently captured and were firing into the trees above us. Now the North Vietnamese were closing in on Lieutenant John Lance Jack Hagen's 2nd Platoon. They were already intermingled with a few survivors of Lieutenant Kroger's 1st Platoon and were maneuvering toward Bob Edwards's foxhole. Clinton S. Poley, 23, 6'3", and the son of an Ackley, Iowa dirt farmer, was assistant gunner on one of Lieutenant Gahagan's M60 machine guns. The gunner was Specialist 4 James C. Comer, a native of Seagrove, North Carolina. Poley says, When I got up, something hit me real hard on the back of my neck, knocked my head forward, and my helmet fell off in the foxhole. I thought a guy had snuck up behind me and hit me with the butt of a weapon. It was such a blow. Wasn't anybody there. It was a bullet from the side or rear. I put my bandage on it and the helmet helped hold it on. I got up and looked again and there were four of them with carbines off to our right front. I told Comer to aim more to the right. After that, I heard a scream, and I thought it was Lieutenant Gahagan. It wasn't. By now, Lieutenant Jack Gahagan was already dead. His platoon sergeant, Robert Jemison Jr., saw him go down trying to help a wounded man. Willie Godbolt was 20 yards to my right. He was wounded, started hollering, "Somebody help me." I yelled, "I'll go get him." Lieutenant Gahagan yelled back, "No, I will." He moved out of his position in the foxhole to help Godbolt and was shot. Just 5 days past his 24th birthday, John Lance Gahagan of Pelham, New York, the only child of proud and doting parents, husband of Barbara and father of six-month-old Camille, lay dead, shot through the head and back, in the tall grass and red dirt of the Iadrang Valley. PFC Willie F. Godbolt of Jacksonville, Florida, also 24 years old, died before help ever reached him. Sergeant Jemison, who helped fight off five Chinese divisions at Chip Young Nee in the Korean War, now took a single bullet through his stomach but kept on fighting. 20 minutes later, the order came down for every platoon to throw a colored smoke grenade to mark friendly positions for the artillery and airstrikes. Jemison got up to throw one and was hit again, this time knocked down by a bullet that struck him in the left shoulder. He got up more slowly now and went back to firing his M16. Jemison fought on until he was hit a third time. It was an automatic weapon. It hit me in my right arm and tore my weapon all to pieces. All that was left was the plastic stock. Another bullet cut off the metal clamp on my chin strip and knocked off my helmet. It hit so hard I thought my neck was broke. I was thrown to the ground. I got up and there was nothing left. No weapon, no grenades, no nothing. James Comer and Clinton Poley, 30 feet to Jemison's left, had been firing their M60 machine gun for almost an hour, an eternity. A stick-handled potato masher grenade landed in front of the hole. Comer hollered, "Get down," and kicked it away a little bit with his foot. It went off. By then we were close to being out of ammo and the gun had jammed. In that cloud of smoke and dust, we started to our left, trying to find other second platoon positions. That's when I got hit in the chest and I hit the ground pretty hard. Poley adds, "I got up and then got shot in my hip and went down again. Comer and I lost contact with each other in the long grass. We'd already lost our ammo bearer, PFC Charlie H. Collier from Mount Pleasant, Texas, who had been killed the day before. He was only 18 and had been in Vietnam just a few days. I managed to run about 20 yards at a time for 3 times and finally came to part of the mortar platoon. A sergeant had 2 guys help me across a clearing to the battalion command post by the large anthill. The battalion doctor, a captain, gave me first aid. Meantime, Specialist Vieira was witness to scenes of horror. The enemy was all over, at least a couple of hundred of them, walking around for 3 or 4 minutes. It seemed like 3 or 4 hours. They were shooting and machine-gunning our wounded and laughing and giggling. I knew they'd kill me if they saw I was alive. When they got near, I played dead. I kept my eyes open and stared at a small tree. I knew that dead men had their eyes open. Vieira continues. Then one of the North Vietnamese came up, looked at me, then kicked me and I flopped over. I guess he thought I was dead. There was blood running out of my mouth, my arm, my legs. He took my watch and my .45 pistol and walked on. I watched them strip off all our weapons. Then they left, back where they came from. I remember the artillery, the bombs, the napalm everywhere, real close around me. It shook the ground underneath me. But it was coming in on the North Vietnamese soldiers, too. All this and much more took place between 6:50 a.m. and 7:40 a.m. on November 15, 1965. The agonies of Charlie Company occurred over 140 yards of the line. But men were fighting and dying on 3 sides of our thinly held American perimeter. In the center, I held the lives of all these men in my hands. The badly wounded Captain Bob Edwards was now on the radio, asking for reinforcements. The only reserve I had was the reconnaissance platoon, 22 men. Was the attack on Charlie Company the main enemy threat? Delta Company and the combined mortar position were also under attack now. Reluctantly, I told Captain Edwards that his company would have to fight on alone for the time being. The din of battle was unbelievable. Rifles and machine guns and mortars and grenades rattled, banged, and boomed. Two batteries of 105mm howitzers, 12 big guns, located on another landing zone 5 miles distant, were firing nonstop, their shells exploding no more than 50 yards outside the ring of shallow foxholes. Beside me in the battalion command post, the Air Force Forward Air Controller, Lieutenant Charlie W. Hastings, 26 from La Mesa, New Mexico, radioed a special code word, Broken Arrow, meaning American unit in danger of being overrun. And within a short period of time, every available fighter bomber in South Vietnam was stacked overhead at 1,000-foot intervals from 7,000 feet to 35,000 feet, waiting its turn to deliver bombs and napalm to the battlefield. Among my sergeants, there were three war men, men who parachuted into Normandy on D-Day and had survived the war in Korea. And those old veterans were shocked by the savagery and hellish noise of this battle. Choking clouds of smoke and dust obscured the killing ground. We were dry-mouthed, and our bowels churned with fear. And still, the enemy came on in waves. Chapter 2. The Roots of Conflict. There never was a time when, in my opinion, some way could not be found to prevent the drawing of the sword. General Ulysses S. Grant. 1 month of maneuver, attack, retreat, bait, trap, ambush, and bloody butchery in the Ia Drang Valley in the fall of 1965 was the Vietnam War's true dawn. A time when two opposing armies took the measure of each other. The North Vietnamese commanders had a deep-rooted fear that the lessons they had learned fighting and defeating the French a decade earlier had been outmoded by the high-tech weaponry and revolutionary airmobile helicopter tactics that the Americans were trying out on them. The North Vietnamese wanted their foot soldiers to taste the sting of those weapons and find ways to neutralize them. Their orders were to draw the newly arrived Americans into battle and search for the flaws in their thinking that would allow a third world army of peasant soldiers who traveled by foot and fought in the distant end of a 2-month-long supply line of porters, not only to survive and persevere, but ultimately to prevail in the war, which was for them entering a new phase. The 1st Cavalry Division Airmobile was born of President John F. Kennedy's determination that the U.S. Army, which for a decade had focused exclusively on training and arming itself to fight World War III on the plains of Europe, prepare to fight a series of small, dirty wars on the world's frontiers. Toward that end, Kennedy gave the U.S. Special Forces their head and a distinctive green beret to wear. The Special Forces were good at what they did, counter-guerrilla warfare, but clearly they were not the force needed to deal with battalions and regiments of regular soldiers in the Communist Armies of Liberation. For that matter, neither were the regular infantry divisions of the U.S. Army, hidebound, roadbound, and focused on war in Germany. Something new and totally different had to be created to meet the challenge of the jungles of Indochina. What would that something be? No one was absolutely certain, but a coterie of young colonels and brigadier generals hiding out in the bowels of the Army's Research and Development Division in the Pentagon had an idea, a dream, and they had been tinkering with it for years. In the summer of 1957, Lieutenant General James M. Gavin, who won early fame and swift promotion with the 82nd Airborne Division in World War II, was chief of research and development for the Army. He had a vision of a new fighting force, something that he described in a seminal article as cavalry, and I don't mean horses. His vision centered on the helicopter, that ungainly bumblebee, which made a very limited combat debut in Korea, principally hauling wounded to the rear two at a time. Jim Gavin's dream was that someday bigger, faster, and better helicopters would carry the infantry into battle, forever freeing it of the tyranny of terrain and permitting war to proceed at a pace considerably faster than that of a man walking. The helicopter, Gavin believed, held the possibility of making the battlefield truly a three-dimensional nightmare for an enemy commander. Gavin's dream was enthusiastically shared by Brigadier General Hamilton W. Howes, Chief of Army Aviation, and other pioneers like Colonel John Norton, Colonel George P. Phipps-Seneff, Colonel John J. Jack Tolson, Colonel Bob Williams, and Colonel Harry W. O. Kennard. World War II had proved there were shortcomings and limitations in the practice of airborne warfare. But airmobile warfare could address most, if not all, of those limitations. By mid-1962, Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara, pursuing President Kennedy's vision, seized on the air mobility idea. McNamara ordered the Army to determine if the new UH-1 Huey helicopter, the big CH-47 Chinook transport helicopter, and their sisters in rotary wing aviation made sense on the battlefield of the future. An air mobility concept board was created, and in short order, the 11th Air Assault Division, TEST, was born at Fort Benning, Georgia, in February 1963. Its commander was Brigadier General Harry Kennard. The 10th Air Transport Brigade, TEST, was activated under the command of Colonel Delbert Bristol, and the Aviation Group, TEST, was created under the command of Colonel Phipps-Seneff. To assess it all was the TEST Evaluation Control Group under Brigadier General Bob Williams. These units would encounter no bureaucratic resistance or red tape at Fort Benning. The new assistant commandant there was Brigadier General John Norton. Talk about stacking the deck. The 11th Air Assault Test began at the bottom and built upward, starting with only 3,000 men for individual air mobility training and testing in platoon size and company size elements. By June of 1964, the Army added two more brigades of infantry, plus artillery and support units, and began training and testing battalion, brigade, and division tactics. At that time, America had not yet recovered from the shock of President Kennedy's assassination, and was only beginning to measure the man who had succeeded him, Lyndon B. Johnson. Johnson was passing the first wave of Great Society legislation, which would restructure America, and that was his main agenda. But the trouble in South Vietnam would not go away, and could not be safely ignored in an election year. The country he called Vietnam was already beginning to gnaw at Lyndon Baines Johnson's innards. It was not the place Johnson would have chosen to make a stand against the communists. In 1954, when the French were trembling on the brink of disastrous defeat at Dien Bien Phu, and President Eisenhower's advisors debated the pros and cons of American intervention in Indochina, intervention possibly even including a nuclear strike, then-Senator Lyndon Johnson stood up strongly against that folly, arguing against any war on the Asian mainland. Johnson was proud of that. Johnson had, however, inherited John F. Kennedy's hyperactive foreign policy, as well as Kennedy's principal advisors, the men he derisively nicknamed the U-Harvards. In Kennedy's 1,000 days, the nation had gone through the Bay of Pigs debacle, the Berlin Wall crisis, the Cuban Missile crisis, and the crisis over the tiny and largely inconsequential kingdom of Laos. Days before Kennedy fell to an assassin's bullet, Ngo Dinh Diem, the autocratic ruler of South Vietnam, was deposed and murdered in a coup d'etat that was at least sanctioned, if not sponsored, by Washington. Kennedy's successor, new to the job and moving into an election year, could not afford to be seen as soft on communism. President Johnson was approving a slow but steady buildup in the number of American advisors in South Vietnam. Now, in the summer of 1964, important decisions were also being made in Hanoi, the capital of communist North Vietnam. In the defense establishment and the ruling councils of the Communist Party, a group of young Turks pressed the case for escalating the war so as to liberate the southern half of the country. They argued that simply to continue providing guns and ammunition and encouragement for the Viet Cong guerrillas was not enough. The time had come to intervene on the battlefields of the South with regiments and divisions of North Vietnamese People's Army regulars. These better armed, trained, and motivated soldiers should infiltrate South Vietnam, they argued, and launch hammer blows against the weak and unmotivated South Vietnamese army. In short order, they would liberate all of the land and people south of the 17th parallel. Senior General Vo Nguyen Giap vigorously opposed the suggested escalation as hasty and premature, and urged that the guerrilla war phase, which was proving ever more successful, be continued. President Ho Chi Minh came down on the side of escalation, and the Army High Command drew up a daring plan for the dry season campaign of 1965. Three regular Army regiments would be brought up to strength, trained and equipped, and sent south along the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos and Cambodia to launch a stunning autumn offensive that would begin in the remote central highlands and perhaps end in Saigon. Hanoi's planners envisioned a classic campaign to crush the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, ARVN, starting in October 1965. After the monsoon rains ended in the mountains and plateaus of Pleiku province. They would lay siege to the American Special Forces camp at Ple Me, with its 12 American advisors and 400-plus Montagnard mercenaries. That attack, in turn, would draw an ARVN relief column of troops and tanks out of Pleiku and down Route 14, thence southwest on the one-lane dirt track called Provincial Route 5, where a regiment of People's Army troops would be waiting in a carefully prepared ambush. Once the ARVN relief forces were destroyed and Ple Me camp crushed, the victorious North Vietnamese Army regiments would then take Pleiku City, and the way would be clear to advance along Route 19 toward Quy Nhon and the South China Sea. Whoever controls Route 19 controls the Central Highlands, and whoever controls the Highlands controls Vietnam. By early 1966, the North Vietnamese commanders were certain South Vietnam would be cut in two and trembling on the verge of surrender. The North Vietnamese preparations were well underway by the fall of 1964, while Lyndon B. Johnson campaigned across America promising that American boys will not be sent to do what Asian boys ought to be doing for themselves. That fall, the 11th Air Assault Test Division conducted a crucial 2-month test in the Carolinas. The theory of helicopter warfare was proved to the satisfaction of the U.S. Army in the largest field exercises since World War II. Now the Pentagon began the process of incorporating the Air Assault Division into the regular ranks of the Army. As the new Airmobile Division moved toward becoming a reality, the situation in the theater of its most likely employment, what Lyndon Johnson called that damned little pissant country Vietnam, deteriorated by the day, both politically and militarily. Saigon's generals took turns staging coups d'etat and being the strong men of the month, while the Viet Cong guerrillas expanded their control of the rice-growing Mekong Delta and reached north into the rubber country. So long as he was presenting himself as the reasonable, peaceful alternative to the hawkish Republican challenger, Senator Barry Goldwater, Johnson resisted the recommendations of his advisors for a massive escalation of the American military presence. Once he had beaten Goldwater and was president in his own right, Lyndon Johnson was certain he could cut a deal in the best Texas tradition with the Vietnamese communists. Already frustrated by a series of terrorist incidents aimed at Americans in Vietnam, Johnson exploded when, on the night of February 6, 1965, Viet Cong sappers mortared and mined the U.S. Advisor's compound and air base at Pleiku in the Central Highlands. 8 Americans were killed and more than 100 wounded. "I've had enough of this," Johnson told his National Security Council. In retaliation, within hours, carrier-based Navy jets struck the first targets inside North Vietnam. By March 2nd, Operation Rolling Thunder, a systematic and continuing program of airstrikes against the North, had begun. While the Navy warplanes safely came and went from aircraft carriers at sea, the U.S. Air Force jets based at Da Nang were clearly vulnerable to enemy retaliation. When General William C. Westmoreland, the American commander in Vietnam, asked for U.S. Marines to guard the airbase, he got them. On March 8th, a battalion of Marines splashed ashore on China Beach. On April 1st, President Johnson approved General Westmoreland's request for 2 more Marine battalions plus 20,000 logistics troops. He also agreed with General Westmoreland that the Marines should not be limited to strictly defensive duties. Now they would fan out and begin killing Viet Cong. For the first time since the Korean War, American combat troops now deployed for action on the Asian mainland. In a major speech on April 7th, the president urged that the North Vietnamese negotiate a reasonable settlement and offered them a piece of a huge Mekong River economic development project that Washington would finance. Hanoi replied that there could be no negotiations while American planes were bombing North Vietnam. On April 15th, the White House was entertaining Westmoreland's request for the dispatch of an additional 40,000 American troops to South Vietnam to raise the ante. In mid-June, Westmoreland urgently asked that the number of U.S. troops in the pipeline be doubled. He now wanted approval of a force of 180,000 men, most of them American, some of them South Korean, by the end of 1965. And the general was projecting that he would need at least an additional 100,000 or more in 1966. President Johnson was inclined to give Westmoreland what he wanted, but he was also determined that this war would be fought without unduly distressing the American public. Surely so rich and powerful a nation could afford both a brushfire war and his Great Society programs. Johnson decided, against the advice of his military chiefs, that the American escalation in South Vietnam be conducted on the cheap. There would be no mobilization of reserve and National Guard units. No declaration of a state of emergency that would permit the Army to extend for the duration the enlistments of the best trained and most experienced soldiers. Instead, the war would be fed by stripping the Army divisions in Europe and the continental United States of their best personnel and materiel, while a river of new draftees, 20,000 of them each month, flowed in to do the shooting and the dying. With the U.S. Marines beginning combat operations in the northern part of South Vietnam and the newly arrived 173rd Airborne Brigade now operating in the central part of the country, Hanoi's military planners were forced to take a new look at the winter-spring campaign planned for Pleiku Province. Senior General Chu Huy Man, who commanded the campaign, says that in June 1965, the People's Army High Command decided to postpone the audacious plan to seize the Central Highlands and attack down Route 19 to the coast. "That plan was postponed for 10 years," General Man says. "It was completed in 1975. The new plan would follow the opening sequence of the original. The People's Army forces would lay siege to Plai Mae Special Forces Camp, ambush the inevitable South Vietnamese relief column when it ventured out of Pleiku City, and then wait for American combat troops to be thrown into the battle to save the South Vietnamese." "We wanted to lure the tiger out of the mountain," General Mann says, adding, we would attack the ARVN, but we would be ready to fight the Americans. Major General Hoang Phuong, new chief of the Institute of Military History in Hanoi, and a veteran of the Ia Drang battles, recalls, "Headquarters decided we had to prepare very carefully to fight the Americans. Our problem was that we had never fought Americans before, and we had no experience fighting them. We knew how to fight the French. We wanted to draw American units into contact for purposes of learning how to fight them. We wanted any American combat troops. We didn't care which ones." The Americans that Mann and Phuong would meet in due course had not yet left the United States in June of 1965, but they smelled something in the wind. In early May 1965, commanders of the 11th Air Assault Division began receiving informational copies of the after-action reports of the 173rd Airborne Brigade's battles and operations in Vietnam. By late May, battalion, brigade, and division commanders and staff were reporting to heavily guarded classrooms at the infantry school in Fort Benning, Georgia, for top-secret map exercises. The maps the games were played on covered the central highlands of South Vietnam. By mid-June, the Pentagon ordered the division commanders to begin an intensive 8-week combat readiness program that focused on deployment to South Vietnam. Secretary of Defense McNamara announced on June 16th that the Army had been authorized an Air Mobile Division as part of its 16-division force. In early July, the Pentagon announced that the 11th Air Assault Test Division would be renamed the 1st Cavalry Division, Air Mobile, and that it would take over the colors of that historic division that had distinguished itself in combat in the Korean War and in the Pacific Theater in World War II. Not to mention horse cavalry skirmishes with bandits along the Mexican border in Texas and New Mexico in the early 1920s. In a televised address to the nation on the morning of July 28, 1965, President Johnson described the worsening situation in South Vietnam and declared, "I have today ordered the Air Mobile Division to Vietnam." On that day, convinced that the president's escalation without a declaration of emergency was an act of madness, General Harold K. Johnson, Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, drove to the White House with the intention of resigning in protest. He had already taken the 4 Silver Stars off each shoulder of his summer uniform. As his car approached the White House gates, General Johnson faltered in his resolve. He convinced himself that he could do more by staying and working inside the system than by resigning in protest. The general ordered his driver to turn around and take him back to the Pentagon. This decision haunted Johnny Johnson all the rest of his life. In South Vietnam, the 320th Regiment of the People's Army of Vietnam was midway through a 2-month-long siege of Duc Co's Special Forces Camp in the Central Highlands. A young Army major, H. Norman Schwarzkopf, West Point class of 1956, was advisor to the South Vietnamese Airborne Battalion that was hip-deep in the fighting at Duc Co. A quarter century later, General Norm Schwarzkopf would date the birth of his famous hot temper to those days, when he begged and pleaded on the radio for someone to evacuate his wounded South Vietnamese soldiers while American helicopters fluttered by without stopping. That week, the 33rd People's Army Regiment left Quang Ninh Province in North Vietnam on the 2-month march down the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos and Cambodia to South Vietnam. Brigadier General Chu Huy Man was already in the south overseeing Viet Cong operations against the U.S. Marines in the Da Nang Chu Lai region. But he had orders to return to the Western Highlands to establish the B-3 Front, a flexible and expandable headquarters charged with tactical and administrative control over both the People's Army and Viet Cong units operating in the highlands. Man's new assignment was to prepare a warm welcome for the Americans in Pleiku Province. The first leg of the new high-tech Air Mobile Division's journey to the war zone would be decidedly low-tech. Beginning in August, the 1st Cavalry would ride to war in a mini fleet of World War II-era troopships, and their helicopters would sail to South Vietnam aboard a flotilla of four aging aircraft carriers. The cavalry troopers launched into a flurry of packing equipment, getting their shots, writing wills, getting last-minute dental and health problems cleared up, resettling their wives and kids off-post, and taking short leaves if they could be spared. In early August, an advance party of 1,100 officers and men flew to Vietnam to begin preparing a new home for the division at An Khe, a sleepy hill town halfway up Route 19 between Quy Nhon on the coast and Pleiku in the mountains. One of the battalions preparing to ship out was mine. My name is Harold G. Moore, Jr., but Hal will do just fine. In 1957, as a young major fresh out of the Command and General Staff College in Fort Leavenworth and assigned to the Pentagon Office of the Chief of Research and Development, I was in on the birth of the concept of air mobility. I was the one-man airborne branch in the Air Mobility Division for 2.5 years. In that job, I worked for Lieutenant General Jim Gavin, Colonel John Norton, Colonel Phipp Seneff, and Colonel Bob Williams. I had already worked for Harry W. O. Kennard when he was a lieutenant colonel heading the airborne test section at Fort Bragg in 1948. As a 26-year-old first lieutenant, I volunteered to test experimental parachutes for Kennard. It was a certainty that Kennard would always remember me. On my first jump, a new steerable parachute I was testing hung up on the tail of the C-46 aircraft, and I was dragged, twisting and trailing behind the plane at 110 miles per hour, 1,500 feet above the drop zone. The tangled mess finally broke free a few minutes later, and my reserve chute got me to ground safely. When I reported in to Kennard, all he said was, "Hello, Lucky." While I was pulling a 3-year tour of NATO duty in Norway in the early 1960s, I heard rumors that the Kennedy administration was taking a hard new look at the air mobility concept. In August of 1963, I finished the NATO tour and began a year of schooling at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. I had been a lieutenant colonel for 4 years and was fighting for battalion command on my next assignment. By then, the Army had created the 11th Air Assault Test Division, with Major General Harry Kennard commanding. I wrote my old boss a letter asking for an infantry battalion in his new division. In those days, a division commander could select brigade and battalion commanders simply by asking for them by name. Since the mid-1970s, such commanders are chosen by Army selection boards on a competitive basis. In April 1964, as I was finishing the War College, the Pentagon informed me that Kennard had requested that I be assigned to command the 2nd Battalion, 23rd Infantry, which had been detached from the 2nd Infantry Division and assigned to the 11th Air Assault Test. On Saturday, June 27th, I arrived at Fort Benning, Georgia. It had been arranged that I would take the 5-day battalion commander refresher course before actually taking command. But any thoughts of a refresher went out the door when Colonel Thomas W. Tim Brown, the 3rd Brigade Commander and my new boss, arrived and told me to turn my course books back in. "You take command of your battalion at 9 a.m. Monday, and we are going out on a 3-day field exercise right after." He gave me the phone number of Captain Gregory Matt Dillon, the battalion S3, or operations officer. Dillon told me that the barracks and headquarters were on Kelly Hill, 5 miles out on the reservation from the main post at Benning. My wife and 5 children were staying with her parents in nearby Auburn, Alabama, until we got quarters on the post. On Monday, June 29th, as scheduled, I took command of my battalion. I was 42 years old, a West Point graduate of the class of 1945, with 19 years commissioned service, including a 14-month combat tour in Korea. In a brief talk to the troops afterward, I told them that this was a good battalion, but it would get better. "I will do my best," I said. "I expect the same from each of you." Even before taking command, I had a long talk with the most important man in any battalion, the Sergeant Major. Basil L. Plumley, 44 years old and a 6'2" bear of a man, hailed from West Virginia. The men sometimes called him Old Iron Jaw, but never in his hearing. Plumley was a two-war man and wore master parachutist wings with 5 combat jump stars. He was what the young airborne types call a 4-jump bastard. Plumley had survived all 4 combat jumps of the 82nd Airborne Division in World War II. Sicily and Salerno in 1943, and then in 1944, D-Day at Normandy, and Market Garden in the Netherlands. For that matter, he also made 1 combat parachute jump in the Korean War with the 187th Airborne Infantry Regiment. He ended World War II a buck sergeant and was promoted to sergeant major in 1961. The sergeant major was a no-bullshit guy who believed, as I did, in tough training, tough discipline, and tough physical conditioning. To this day, there are veterans of the battalion who are convinced that God may look like Sergeant Major Basil Plumley, but he isn't nearly as tough as the sergeant major on sins small or large. Privately, I thanked my lucky stars that I had inherited such a treasure. I told Sergeant Major Plumley that he had unrestricted access to me at any time on any subject he wished to raise. After the ceremony, the company commanders and battalion staff got a look at their new boss and a word on my standards. They were fairly simple. Only first-place trophies will be displayed, accepted, or presented in this battalion. Second place in our line of work is defeat of the unit on the battlefield and death for the individual in combat. No fat troops or officers. Decision-making will be decentralized. Push the power down. It pays off in wartime. Loyalty flows down as well. I check up on everything. I am available day or night to talk with any officer of this battalion. Finally, the sergeant major works only for me and takes orders only from me. He is my right-hand man. Personal descriptions of the key players in the 11th Air Assault Division and in my battalion that year will be useful to the listener. These men appear and reappear throughout this story. Major General Harry W. O. Kennard, Division Commanding General. Harry Kennard, a native Texan, was 49 years old that year. He was West Point, class of 1939, and airborne qualified in 1942. Kennard was one of the shooting stars of the 101st Airborne in World War II. He was Brigadier General Tony McAuliffe's Operations Officer G3 at the Battle of Bastogne in the Bulge, and the man who suggested that General McAuliffe specifically respond to a German surrender demand with one historic word, nuts. Kennard became a full colonel at age 29. Brigadier General Richard T. Knowles, Assistant Division Commander. Dick Knowles was 45, a Chicago native. He held an ROTC commission from the University of Illinois. Knowles served in Europe in World War II in a tank destroyer group. In Korea, he made the Incheon landing with an Army artillery battalion attached to the 1st Marine Division. Later in North Korea, he earned the Silver Star, leading a counterattack that routed 75 North Koreans who had penetrated his battalion perimeter. He originally came to the 11th Air Assault as a colonel commanding the division artillery. When Knowles was promoted to brigadier general, he shifted to assistant division commander for operations, and in this capacity, he spent most of his time in the field supervising the training and operations of the division. Knowles was slender, 6'3" tall, and enthusiastic. He always arrived with a pocketful of good cigars. Colonel Thomas W. Brown, 3rd Brigade Commander. Tim Brown was 44 years old and 6'1" tall. He was West Point class of January 1943, a native New Yorker, and another World War II paratrooper who had served with the 11th and 13th Airborne Divisions. He and I were students together at the Infantry School Advanced Course in 1951 to 1952, and we served together in the 7th Infantry Division in the Korean War. In 1952 to 1953, he was a battalion commander in the 32nd Infantry Regiment, while I commanded two companies and was operations officer of the 17th Infantry Regiment. Brown was quiet, cool, incisive, and perfectionistic. In the true canard mode, he gave his battalion commanders guidance, then gave them the freedom to run their